From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. Now, as part of the Natural History Museum of Utah's lecture series, Dr. Suzanne Simard, professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia, will be giving a talk in West Jordan on March 18th.
In her lecture, Dr. Simard will help audiences understand just how vital trees are, not just to ecosystems, but to each other, and most importantly, us. That's in the first part of the show.
And then in the second part of the show, Utah geologist Jeremiah Bernal joins us to discuss the Bonneville Salt Flats, its origins and evolutions over geological history.
It has been long assumed that the Salt Flats was formed as its ancient namesake lake dried up 13,000 years ago. But new research from the University of Utah has changed that narrative, determining these crusts did not form until several thousand years after Lake Bonneville disappeared. Jeremy Bernard will help explain and provide us more detail on this new research. All that, and if we have some time, some news on our water conditions here in the state for the last month or so. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, and we are excited to welcome our first guest, who is Dr. Suzanne Simard. And Dr. Simard has not only written some books, but also a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia, and will be giving a talk in West Jordan on March 18th. And it's a lecture to help audiences understand how vital trees are, not just to ecosystems, but to each other, and most importantly, to us. Welcome to the show, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Now, first, what I want to do is have you tell us a little bit about yourself and your path that led you to study trees.
Yeah, so I live in British Columbia, and I grew up in the inland rainforests of British Columbia. My family came from, we were French settler families who emigrated from Quebec in the late 1800s, and we had a long history as sawyers or sawyers, log cutters. And so I grew up in these old forests among my family of horse loggers. And so I just became a lover of the forest, and I eventually became a forest ecologist and a professor at UBC.
Now, you also made some very interesting discoveries along the way as you started to study trees. I want you to tell us about your discovery with photosynthesis and the wide wood web, as it's described.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you think about trees, they're as you said, they photosynthesize. That means that they take in carbon dioxide, they breathe it in through their stomata, if you will, and they convert it to sugars. And these sugars are used to basically grow a tree. And in the process, they breathe out oxygen. So a good way to think of a tree is that when they breathe out and they breathe out, we breathe in. We breathe in the oxygen they create. And that sugar or that food that they make, at least half of it goes into their roots and into this fungal network that are help the tree in taking up water and nutrients from the soil in exchange for this food or these sugars. And they use the sugars then to grow their own bodies. And some of these fungi can actually connect trees together. And that is what the wood wide web is. It's the connections among the trees below ground through these mycorrhizal fungi. So it's a lot like aspen clones. They're connected by root grafts or a root system. And they also form a big wood wide web.
So we know, obviously, trees play a critical role in with respect to climate change and their role in, you know, like you say, taking in carbon dioxide. What is there a rule of thumb relationship between, say, the stoichiometry there of carbon dioxide taken in and oxygen given off? Is it a one-to-one basis, or is it a little different than that?
For CO2 and
oxygen, carbon dioxide. And CO2 taken and oxygen released.
Yeah, I mean, it's roughly equivalent. So you do need to have both of these things going on, and the equivalent amount of photosynthesis goes on. It creates the equivalent amount of oxygen. I think it's like 6 CO2s to produce one sugar molecule and 6 oxygen molecules,
okay,
roughly, in the equation of photosynthesis. They require water in this process. As well, and so carbon dioxide and water combine to create the sugar and the oxygens. So yeah, I guess if you were to think about, you know, everything that an aspen tree does or a tree does helps us in an equivalent way.
And are there some trees that do a better job than others at taking in CO2 and giving off O2?
Well, certainly deciduous trees have, so deciduous trees being broadleaf trees like aspens, are capable of photosynthesizing at higher rates than conifers. They just have a different strategy. Their life trait is to shed their leaves in the fall, and so they have to do all of their work in a fairly short period of time during the summer or the growing season. Whereas a coniferous tree lives, you know, longer, it has to put more energy into defending itself against old age, if you will, and the things that come along with old age. And so they're putting some of their energy into that instead of growing quickly. And so, yeah, it's just kind of a different life strategy.
So, of course, we have this symbiotic, this relationship with trees, and our connection to nature is one of the most important things, or maybe the most important, to find ways to not only save these forests, but solutions to our climate change. Can you talk about some of the issues or some of the vulnerable things that are happening to our forests, not only the peril that we as humans are putting on them, but also what's happening in the earth and how that's being combated or your work within that?
Yeah, that's such an excellent question. So forests globally cover about 1/3 of the land area, or 31%, and yet they contain about 90% of the terrestrial or the earthly biomass. So they play this huge outsized role in our ecosystems. They contain about 80% of the terrestrial carbon. And carbon is important to us because right now, you know, we're putting too much of it in the atmosphere and removing it through fossil fuels and land use change, which means converting sort of natural habitat to other habitats or other uses. And those two activities of burning of fossil fuels and land use change is what's causing human-caused climate change. And so the more CO2 we put up in the atmosphere, the warmer it's getting. And the science is very solid on this. It's tracking along as scientists have said and modeled for a long time. The good news is that the CO2 emission is starting to level off because of the concerted efforts of humans. But we still are in a lot of a very critical stage in quite a fragile moment in what we do to address this urgent situation. I know that where I live, you know, some that urgency is expressed in like wildfires that have become quite extreme in the last five or six or seven years. Last year, you guys might know that Canada had the biggest wildfire year on record, where we actually burned something like 18 million hectares of forest across Canada in wildfire. This is a consequence of global change. It's also a consequence of management practices, which we've actually increased the flammability of our landscape by suppressing fire. So the fire, you know, the forests of North America have long, since millennia, have been, you know, stewarded by the indigenous people who used fire for a whole bunch of reasons, and one of them is to reduce risk of wildfire. In Canada, anyway, those cultural burns were outlawed in the early 1900s, and this resulted in an increase in fuels. So reducing these fuels is one of the essential tools for addressing climate change.
I'm going to take a wild guess as to why those cultural fires were outlawed. Was it because perhaps that it got in the way of potential logging activities?
That is exactly it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So one for, you know, they had to give up their cultural activities to support the, you know, economic growth and expansion, et cetera. Well, I don't want to get too far down the road on that, but that's an interesting observation. So, so you had these wildfires throughout British Columbia and Canada writ large. Were these kind of naturally set? Were they man-made, or were they just a lot of, let's say, lightning strikes and other things?
Yeah, I don't know the exact stats on the 2023 fires on what initiated them, but generally in Canada, about half of the fires are started by lightning and half by humans. A lot of these fires were in very remote boreal forests, and so most of it was likely by lightning. There's a lot of things going on with lightning. Of course, you can't control it, but because we've heated our atmosphere, we actually have generated more lightning.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that, combined with the very hot and dry conditions that were building up over the summer, resulted in this explosive situation.
And once a boreal forest burns, what's the time period for some form of, quote unquote, recovery?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So one thing I'll say is that some of these fires are still burning.
Wow.
They call them zombie fires.
Yeah.
When, they're put out in the summer or the fall, but they go underground into the soil, into the peat, and they just smolder away, and then they flare up again in the following year. So they're already starting to flare up. So how long does it take to recover it? It really depends. If it's a light, cool burn, which these were not, the systems recover very quickly. They're adapted to fire, right? The grasses and the trees, the aspen and so on, they recover very quickly. But severe burns, which is what we're seeing more of because of these fuel buildups, they burn deep and severely. And so, in some of our older fires here that happened maybe 5 years ago, the recovery is very patchy. So I expect the same will be true for these fires from last year, that it's going to take a long time in some areas for them to recover, and some will recover quickly. But it's a big concern.
We are speaking with Dr. Suzanne Simard, who is a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia and who's going to be giving a talk in West Jordan. We're going to talk about some of the things that you're going to share with the students there, but I also wanted to get to some of the discoveries that were happening in labs and then you took from theory into practice that I've heard you speak about. Can you share with us some of the science that you're working with to help trees continue that connection to each other underneath the soil?
Yeah, another great question. Keeping in mind my history, I came from a forestry family. I became a forester, and the practice of forestry is really about converting, the old forests to new forests that are, managed forests. And what I was seeing was that we were simplifying the forest by removing plants we didn't want, ostensibly to increase the growth of the trees we did want, which at home were like pines and Douglas firs and spruces. But in that simplification of the ecosystem, I was measuring, increases in pest infestations, so diseases and insect infestations. And so this got me looking at you know, I felt like we were disconnecting the forest. And so this got me looking at connection. And it was through that discovery that below ground, that all these trees are connected together by these fungal networks, was astounding. And it turned upside down how we saw forests. You know, we saw forests as individuals that were competing with each other. Now we understood the forest as a system that worked together, you know, with all these complex interactions going on, you know, like a really intact, cohesive system. And so I've taken that concept and said, let's do better forest management. And I've started a project called the Mother Tree Project. So keeping in mind that the big trees in a forest are the ones that are the hubs of this network. They're the ones that basically are the center linchpin of the forest, and it connects with all the smaller trees. And there's signaling that happens between these trees. So I thought, let's try to keep that intact. And so we're trying different ways of retaining these old trees to try to transform logging practices, which in Canada is almost completely clear-cut logging. Some of it is clear-cutting, leaving a few trees behind, but generally it's just clear-cutting. And so this is sort of the idea is to transform forestry so that it better emulates what the forest needs. And we've found that the more of these old trees you leave behind, the better it is for the ecosystem. You know, there's better biodiversity. There's more carbon that's protected in the forest. And the regeneration of the forest in these Douglas fir forests is better. And so in Canada or in British Columbia, I'm actually at a workshop today to discuss how to implement some of these, you know, practices where we actually leave the old trees behind instead of cutting them down.
I'm guessing that's kind of inverse or the obverse of what logging practices typically were, as you know, as I remember watching my Disney films, that they would be clear cut and then a lot of young trees, or maybe a few young trees, were left behind, thinking that, oh well, these are the young ones, the adolescents, will let them grow and they'll spread out and they'll benefit the soil and the ecosystems that way. But you're suggesting quite a bit different.
Yes, it's actually flipped it right on its head.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's like elders in our communities, we need them. Ecosystems need them too. They hold species diversity. You know, an old tree has got higher fungal diversity in its root system. It's got greater lichen diversity on it. It protects a greater diversity of plants around them. They are more resistant to fire. They have deeper root systems that bring water up from below and then spread it around and keep the ecosystem moist. So we're discovering all kinds of reasons, but you're absolutely right that logging practices first targeted the big old trees because they were the most lucrative.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when you call it finding the mother tree, it is like these older trees, these elders are sending out a nurturing chemicals or signals to all these younger trees. How does that work? What does that connection look like, or those signals look like?
Yeah, you know, it's quite fascinating, and we don't know everything yet. And people, there's scientists all over the world who are working on this, trying to understand better. But you know, you think of an old tree, you know, we all know what they look like. They're the great big ones that, you know, stick out in the forest that you see. They shed seeds. Those seeds land on the soil, and then the seedlings germinate. And within a few months, like we find within 3 months, those seedlings are linked into this big network that's supported by the old tree. So this big fungal network that is busy pulling up water and nutrients from the soil. So the seedlings tap into that, and they benefit from, you know, this big network that's basically being fed by the old trees. And so that is the biggest benefit, is that they just get a head start. And then what we're discovering is that little parcels of water and carbon and nitrogen are transmitted through these networks. We don't know exactly what they do to, you know, to help the seedlings, even if, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether it's a significant help or not. But what we are discovering is that, yes, that there are these nutrients passing through the network, and even signals, as you mentioned. So these signals, we know that, for example, that they transmit information about defense. So if a tree is being attacked by some kind of caterpillar, this is exactly what we looked at. We looked at Western spruce budworm attacking Douglas firs, and we found that signals traveled to nearby ponderosa pines, and the ponderosa pines were able to defend themselves against that same insect, or at least they got the message to upregulate their defense enzymes. Right. So that is a fascinating way. And we also know other scientists that these signals also move through the air, that these defense warning systems are all through the air as well as through the soil.
So not just species to species communicating, but species to other species of trees.
Yes.
So firs to aspens potentially communicating with each other.
Yes. So I looked at, in my doctoral thesis a couple decades ago, I looked at these networks and the movement of carbon or photosynthate below ground from paper birch to Douglas fir. And so, yes, I mean, I haven't looked specifically at aspen and fir, but my guess is, a comparable thing is likely would be going on. But I don't think those studies have been done.
And you're going to be speaking on the 18th of March. What are some of the messages that you want to send, and what is some of the things that you want people to take away during your speech?
Yeah, I want people to gain a better appreciation of how vital forests are, how complex they are, how connected they are, and that people play a huge role in the health of these connected ecosystems. We can have positive effects, through our practices, for example, burning the forest when they need to be burned, tending the forest when the fuel loads get too high, looking after them, as opposed to exploiting them, there's a long history of that where I come from, which is causing it's making the forest more unhealthy because they're more uniform. So how do you reintroduce a better practice that will care for these forests? I think that's one of the big messages. And the other is just to appreciate these are highly connected ecosystems, and they're highly sophisticated. And we're barely scratching at the surface, but to honor and respect that, and have reverence for that highly evolved, complex, and some would say intelligent system.
And I know the talk you're giving is in West Valley, and we only have a couple minutes left or so. Talk about, the importance of, or the observations of West Valley, part of Salt Lake City, West Jordan, and what your talk is going to address.
Well, I'd like to talk about, I know forests are under threat all over the world. I know that, that our forests are, suffering from a lot of stress, drought stress, wildfire stress. The same thing is happening in your forest. And to just talk about what we can do about this, because it's we're in an urgent situation, but we have a lot of agency in addressing it. And so that's what I want to talk to the people about, is to just provide some ideas and actions that can be done to help protect your forests, because the forests are so vital, not just because they're important for biodiversity and climate change, but for our own spirituality and our own human well-being. But they need tending just as much as we need tending.
Well, Dr. Suzanne Simard, such wonderful information, and you have been instrumental in the understanding of the connection of our forests. And also, you are an author of the book, Finding the Mother Tree. So how could people find out more about you, your studies, and get your book?
Yeah, I have a website that addresses the research I'm doing. It's called mothertreeproject.org. And so you can go to that, and you can learn all about these studies. There's a bunch of, there's little podcasts and videos on there that really, quickly you'll learn about these discoveries. And you can think about doing similar work in your own area. We have this large project called the Mother Tree Project, mm-hmm. which covers a large latitudinal gradient through Douglas fir forests, trying to project, you know, what will we do, what will it look like as climate changes and warms up as you go north. You can, you know, Utah can join the Mother Tree Project and become part of this wonderful experiment.
Fantastic. Oh. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure we have a million more questions for you. And I'm excited for the students that get to hear you speak. And hopefully we can have you back on the show sometime.
Yes, we will.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much. I really appreciate it. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Let's take a break for a couple underwriters. And we come back, we're going to turn our attention to, a very treeless landscape, the Bonneville Salt Flats. Its origins and histories, it's This Green Earth. We'll be right back. Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the second part of this show is Jeremy Bernal. He's a geologist with the Utah Geological Survey, and he's here to talk about history, origins, etc., of the Bonneville Salt Flats and some recent discoveries about the origins of these salt flats. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you, Chris.
Let's start here. We like to get a little background on our guests. So give us a little background about yourself.
Sure. So I recently just finished my PhD at the University of Utah. And so that's where I conducted most of the research we'll be discussing today. And then I extended some of it on a project related to this at the Utah Geological Survey.
All right. So now we can refer to you as Dr. Jeremy Bernal. Congratulations. So how long have you been researching, say, the Bonneville Salt Flats? And give us a little background on kind of the location and the size of the salt flats.
Sure. So I first was exposed to the Bonneville Salt Flats in 2016 when my PhD advisor recruited me. But I've been working, I worked on the Bonneville Salt Flats for about 5-6 years, starting in 2017. So I'm very intimately familiar with this landscape. And as for its location, if you head out on I-80 westward towards Reno and drive for about an hour and a half, so that's about 100 miles due west of Salt Lake City as the crow flies, right on the Utah-Nevada border, there is a salt pan that you will drive by, and that is the Bonneville Salt Flats. And in terms of how big the salt flats are, they're about 30 to 40 square miles. So they cover a really vast area, and it's quite visually striking because it's a surface consisting of a hard crystalline halite or salt crust. So it's very reflective and aesthetically pleasing, but also it's very unique. And we're fortunate in Utah to have one of these few rare landscapes.
So this is an environmental show. We talk about the environment. Is there a form of environment or ecosystem within the salt flats?
Yes. So I've actually worked with microbiologists from the University of Utah, and they've actually gone through and collected sediment from the salt crust and discovered that there's actually a very thriving and unique ecosystem consisting of different microbial organisms within the landscape. And this is actually one of the few and very great analogs for us looking at potential microenvironments and preservation potential for samples from Mars. And so it's really valuable in that instance. As for macro fauna and flora, when you're out of the surface, it does look very barren and desolate. The most you'll typically see are a few bugs here and there, but once we did see a mouse, and we do not know how it got out there.
Well, you're talking now about the state of the salt flats today, but it does have a rich history. Of course, it was first Lake Bonneville, but that dried up, was it 13,000 years ago?
Yes, that's correct, 13,000 years ago.
So when you go through this rich history, can you kind of take us through where it was back in those days to now? Like, what were the causes? What was happening that this occurred?
Sure. So many of you are probably familiar with Lake Bonneville. It was a large lake about equal in size to Lake Michigan that covered about a third of the state of Utah from around 30,000 years ago to 13,000 years ago when it first dried up. And for a long time, it was thought that as this lake dried up, it left behind a lot of salt. So that's the solutes and minerals dissolved in water. And that is where the Bonneville Salt Flats came from. Mm-hmm. And what we learned in this study is that it's possible that there was salt deposited after that, but it was not actually being preserved in the geological record. So after Lake Bonneville dried up, what we can see from the depositional record is actually that there was a period probably somewhere between 12,000 and 8,000 years ago that was actually very dry. And during that period, there was a lot of actually erosion and sediment deflation. And so about 5 feet of sediment just got blown away in the wind, creating quite a lot of dust. And so that's one thing that when we look at modern change happening with the Great Salt Lake, this can serve as an analog for that, where we could have a lot of potential dust creation and exposure as these saline systems dry out over time. And then around 8,000 years ago, we began to see a shift in terms of our deposition at the salt flats. Instead of it being just an erosive surface creating a lot of dust, we began to see the accumulation of gypsum. So gypsum is a mineral that we have all been exposed to it because it's what drywall is made out of. Mm. And that forms from the evaporation of water over time. And so that gypsum began to accumulate between about 8,000 years ago and 5,500 years ago. And so it accumulated with that and a bit of mud. But really, the salt flats first began to look like, in terms of what we see preserved, with a hard salt crust. It didn't really begin to look like that until 5,500 years ago. So if you think about, we originally thought this was a salt crust that formed 13,000 years ago, and now we realize actually it formed 5,500 years ago. That's more than half, almost triple, in terms of lowering the age of this landscape in the way that we currently see that. And a lot of that was actually associated with climatic shifts, which I was really excited to see that kind of match between our data. So basically, when we had an environment that was a lot drier and hotter, there was a lot more erosion occurring within the system. And then as the system became cooler and wetter around 5,500 years ago, that's when we began to see the accumulation of salt within the system that began to build the salt crust. And basically, it's been fluctuating a little bit since then with kind of somewhat constant or some variation deposition in the past 5,000 years.
So 5,000 years, geological terms, blink of an eye for a geologist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's one thing I've realized working on this landscape is it's very ephemeral. So we went and actually looked at deposits from before Lake Bonneville, and we didn't see any evidence for a salt flat being occurring at this area in the past 50,000 years, other than the modern saline pan.
So when you're looking at this now, and we're talking about this warming planet and this climate, and you're saying that doesn't help in the formation of salt, but the erosion of it and scattering that dust. So what does that mm-hmm. mean for not only the people who live in Utah, but I'm assuming that this is going to have rippling effects?
Yeah, so one thing we've learned is that salt flats do need water. And you're right, we see climate right now that's becoming increasingly hot and dry. And so that is not a good sign for preserving this landscape over longer periods. And dust is very much a large concern within Utah in terms of health effects. I know we have some of the highest respiratory illnesses within Salt Lake City. But in addition to that, it can contribute to increased rates of snowmelt, so further exacerbating our problems with water conservation right now. So it is something that I think will continue to be a problem at the current rate.
Okay, so how has this new research been received? I'm always curious about, you know, researchers presenting papers that have dramatic conclusions, let's say, you know, quote unquote. How are things going with this reception of this new research?
Well, to give some bigger context for this research, the Bonneville Salt Flats is an area that has been under a lot of dynamic change in the past 100 years. And in part, that's driven to many interactions from human activity. So today we discussed the climate part of things. But in addition to that, the system has been actively mined for potash, which is a vital nutrient for our modern agricultural system. It just won't work without it for about 100 years. And the process of mining potash removes water and salts out of the salt crust over time. So we've seen since at least 1960 a decrease in the salt crust thickness by about a third. And during the same period, we've also seen a decrease in the area of the salt crust over time. So that just provides some context for this research and larger things. And I do know there's been some concerns with trying to get funding for restoring this landscape. And I think this research really highlights basically the ephemeral nature of the landscape. And we can try to manage it as humans and try to make it look like the current state that we see it in and what we've known for our lives. But as you said, this is just really a geological blink of the eye in terms of what we see. So I think this highlights just the importance of looking at the different time scales within these systems to really understand how they're changing over time, and then put some of the levers that we can use to try to influence them in perspective.
We're speaking with Dr. Jeremiah Bernal. Sorry about that. It's Jeremiah Bernal, geologist, and we're talking about the Bonneville Salt Flats, its history, origins, and actually, you know, you just mentioned things have changed just within the past 5, 6, 7 decades, within a lifetime of a geologist. that's incredible. And so the changes continue there.
Yeah, it's been a very dynamic system, and I was fortunate in my PhD to really get a chance to look at all aspects of the landscape. I've been able to focus on how groundwater is moving through the system, and really it is very dynamic, but some of the results that we've been able to show from that is that a lot of our human activities are contributing to the decreases in the water input into this landscape. And I think the one thing that this study highlights is the importance of climate as well as water inputs to the saline landscape in terms of maintaining them. And that's definitely creating a challenge for us going forward and then determining the best ways to try to manage it.
And I'm curious, as you go out there and study this, what kind of tools or activities do you do to understand what's happening or to date this landscape? What are you using to do that?
Yeah, so specifically for the study looking at the depositional history, the main thing we used was collecting cores. So that's basically if you take a straw and insert it into the ground and pull that out, we can get basically a stack of sediment, and we can collect subsamples from that and look at basically things that will tell us about the environment over time. So we can use geochemistry to look at different water sources and how those water sources might have changed in terms of where water was coming from. So for example, with Great Salt Lake, we actually know that there was a change in water supply with it in the past because the Bear River didn't always flow into the system. And so that was one thing that we looked at. In terms of dating the salt crust, we used radiocarbon. And fortunately, there was a palynologist, but someone who works on pollen at the University of Utah, who was able to help us collect the pollen samples and process them. And then we were able to just send them to the lab and get radiocarbon samples. And that was really vital for helping us build an understanding of when our depositional conditions changed and put them into the greater perspective of what we know about the climate at those times.
So what does, you mentioned management of the mm-hmm. salt flats. What would that look like? You know, I'm always curious as like what does success look like when we're trying to manage ecosystems or physical systems like this. What has to be done to keep the salt flats in good, I don't know, healthy shape?
So for the past 25 years, they've been doing a program called the Laydown Program. And so that basically involves taking waste halite, a salt product from the potash mine, because they don't want that, dissolving it with groundwater, which is actually about 10 to 20,000 year old groundwater, and then pumping that back across the highway, Interstate 80, and letting that basically evaporate and then form a salt crust again. And the results from that project have been mixed. We've shown in the past year or two that actually some of the salinity below the salt crust is beginning to be restored over time. But the initial project, when they first started this, they anticipated that it would grow 2 to maybe 3 inches of salt on the crust, and that didn't happen. And another thing we've shown is that the laydown program is using a very valuable resource in this area, which is groundwater. And that's groundwater that's over 10,000 years old, and it's not likely to be restored within our lifespan. And as a part of that, we're actually seeing a negative impact upon the Bonneville salt flat system, where actually mining groundwater is helping remove salt water that helps support the salt flats from below. So it's as if we're taking a bowl and we're trying to fill it by taking water from below it and then dumping it on top, but we're losing water from evaporation throughout this entire process.
Right.
So can you also tell us a little bit about the Global Change and Sustainability Center that is helping coordinate some of these researches and training in natural and human built systems?
So I can talk a little bit to that. My PhD advisor, Brenda Bowen, is the head of the Global Change and Sustainability Center, so that's more of her strength. But they were really essential in providing us support in terms of financial support. They helped fund some of my research projects as well as presentations at different conferences. But the most important thing, I think, about the Global Change and Sustainability Center was that it really provided a venue for me to get to know researchers at the University of Utah outside of my area of expertise. And that led to some very exciting papers that really I wouldn't have been able to do by myself. So I think that was one key strength to that.
So this collaboration has been good, and it has led to some of not only this information that you're dispelling now through this research study, but hopefully in future we will find, you know, I guess better ways in which to cope with this, handle this, or help this, I guess.
I think all of the above. I mean, one thing that kind of came from that is this National Science Foundation grant, which is what I was doing the research under. It was an interdisciplinary grant. So I got to work with people in the communications department and also people in the geography department who looked at how we as humans interact with our landscapes and which part of it we look at and how our perceptions are changed by the framing of the language around the landscape. So I think it really helps broaden your horizons as a researcher and really makes you better at communicating.
What are your hopes, I guess, for the future? Like, as you study this, as it's become probably a little bit personal to you, what are your hopes mm-hmm. moving forward?
Well, I like how you said it has become personal. It's been mm-hmm. becomes difficult at times to separate my identity from the salt crust just because it is such an integral part of my being. But my hopes for the future of the salt crust is that we can use some of this new data that we've collected and really begin to highlight and narrow down which ways of managing it will be the most effective at, you know, maintaining this landscape, not only in the near term, but also decades and centuries into the future.
And of course, a listener texted me a question regarding the human use of the salt flats, right? Most people know the salt flats as somewhere where we go and strap jet engines to our backs and drive 300 yes. miles an hour. Does that have an impact on the salt flats, or is it just a small location of the total salt flat area?
So preparing the racetrack does have some influences on the crust. As for the scale of those influences relative to the effect of mining and water extraction, that's something that we're actively working on. I do think most of the data right now is indicating, in terms of magnitude, it's smaller than the effects of mining. And I don't know, it's hard to put things into perspective because this is not an ideal experiment where we can just change one variable. Over this entire period, we've been racing, we've been mining, trying to restore the landscape, and also the climate's been changing. So it's challenging to put that into character. But racing is one of the main reasons why we are interested in this landscape. It's because it does have such a really diverse and infested community or invested community around it, and trying to understand how this landscape is changing, how we can adapt to that.
I'm still trying to understand where that mouse came from. I think there's a...
Oh, I have no idea.
Someone's car, maybe?
I hope it got in on
a car. Do you think it was?
Yeah.
Yes, I bet it was
right.
a car.
So it kind of...
I had one in my car when I was a high schooler. So.
No, that's, I don't mean to be flip, but that's an interesting theory. We got to wrap up. Where can people go to learn more about the work you do and the Bonneville Salt Flats?
So there's a lot of resources right now on the Utah Geological Survey website. So if you look for the Bonneville Salt Flats there. And we also have another resource that we're working on putting out in the next month or two. And so I'm looking forward to sharing that. But that is the best place to find information and resources about the salt flats right now.
All right, Dr. Jeremiah Bernal, geologist with the Utah Geological Survey. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you, Chris and Claire.
Thank you.
All right.